This is SaaS Scaled, the podcast where data meets action with host Armon Shrocky. Each week, Armon will be sitting down with CEOs and industry leaders from the technology sector, giving you the insight to innovate without reinventing the wheel. They'll discuss challenges, best practices, and how to identify the right metrics. So if you want to get to market faster and in a way that matters, then subscribe and join us every week as we discuss SaaS Scale. This episode is brought to you by Curvey, the modern no-code analytics solution, the tools you need to take action with your data on a platform built for maximum scalability, security, and cost efficiencies. If you're ready to reduce complexity and dramatically lower costs, then contact us today at curvey.com. That's Q-R-V-E-Y.com.
Hello, welcome to another episode of SaaS Scaled. I'm pleased to have Suri with us, and we are going through a great discussion. So welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you so much for having me on, Armon. Happy to be here.
Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you guys do?
Sure. So I'm the founder and CEO of a company called Rocket Lane. Think of us as a platform that helps with both the front end and back end of running, client-facing project delivery team. So on the front end of it, you need to collaborate with customers, run the project, manage the project, the risks, and, you know, governance around it, deliver the right experience to the customer. On the back end of it, you need to staff the project with the right team, account for the efforts that are going into the projects, invoice the customers on time, do your revenue recognition right. A lot of things happen on both the front end and the back end, and we sort of are all-in-one platform for this.
Okay, I know that you have also a prior experience with building a company, building a product, selling it as well. Can you tell us a little bit about that part before you start, you know, what you are working on today?
Sure. So I started my career as a product manager. And from 2012 to 2015, I ran another startup with the same co-founders. We built a messaging product. Again, it was in SaaS. Got acquired by a company called Freshworks in 2015. Continued to build that business within Freshworks from 2015 till end of 2019. So it was overall like a 7.5 year journey with two sort of restarts of selling that product, because we relaunched it within Freshworks twice. And then it became a big success within Freshworks. 2020. Started the new journey with Rocket Lane. So, you know, pretty contrasting journeys as well.
Fantastic. What do you think is kind of the shared experience in both kind of journeys, right? So what is the most common part that you actually see that is repeating? And even if you do the third one, it will repeat again.
I think two aspects, maybe three, come to mind. One is, I think last time and this time, we built a very differentiated product in our space. Both times, it wasn't just differentiated, also what I can call a full-featured product. We didn't start with, here is a minimal version that people should try out and then take feedback to develop. But instead, we said we will do a lot of research, learn a lot about the space, and build the right product. But it will already feel full-featured in a way. You know, people won't look at it as an early-stage product. They should look at it as a replacement for something that they've been using for years. And the third aspect, I would say, is this idea that, when we launch a full-featured product, it can cater to both the, you know, SMB, mid-market, and lower end of enterprise in one shot. We don't need to pick one segment. We'll sort of build it for all of them. Yes, it'll continue to mature to cater better to larger customers, but we're not going to exclude the, you know, bottom SMB customers. We're going to build something that still can serve SMB and can serve enterprise. So I think those, I would say, are the three common things between the two startups.
So when you do that, you have to really define some milestones. You have to define some kind of, you know, points of the product that you say, this is MVP, or this is ready to be released, or this is the beta. And this is very critical, right? So especially at the beginning, because if you really go immaturely to the product, to the market, and provide them a product that is not sufficient, you may get a different reaction versus if you really worked on it maybe too much and you go to market too late, and then you learn things that surprise you, and then you have to go back and redo, and you may wish that I wish I would have been in front of this customer 6 months ago or 2 years ago rather than now. How do you define those kind of lines and borders and kind of, you know, milestones?
Right. I think definitely the first experience gave us a lot of insight to do it right the second time. Though even the first time we did a full-featured product, I think this time we had a lot more confidence on what is the scope which will get people to start using it. And I would say we use different aspects of it. One is we do look at what are they using today. For example, for implementation teams, typically they're using a combination of a project management tool, you know, to run their projects, right? They use document collaboration tools, they use Slack shared channels, they use a bunch of things. And there are experiences within those that matter a lot to them. So our job early on, the first 3 months, was just understanding how people are using the software, what matters most to them, and what differentiation is going to matter most to them. So identifying like 5 or 6 areas where we can really innovate and show here is why you need to shift, but also cover the bases on you know, the core aspects where they don't feel I'm having to miss something over here to come to this. So you're getting this differentiation, but you're also getting all the basics you need is what we wanted to get to. So there was a lot of conversation with customers, showing them, not giving them the access to the product, but showing them the product and asking questions, or asking them to show us how they use their current software to get to a level of comfort with here is that minimal first version. Which still is differentiated. The other unique thing this time we did was, you know, our product by nature was a unification play. So it was trying to do project management, document collaboration. There was a customer portal. There was like conversations happening. All of it is core to that first version. So we actually wrote down why we're doing what we're doing, what is going to be that size of the first product, what are the non-negotiables that need to go into that first version. Before we actually launch, kept validating it. It took us a year to get to launch. We didn't do like a 3 month, here is the basic version. We said we're going to build something fairly comprehensive. But every week we would have multiple customer conversations, prospect conversations, just to say, we want to keep you posted on how this is coming along, get your thoughts, and also learn more from you. So we kept doing that journey. In fact, our investors, early investors did ask us, you know, looks like you've built a lot. Why don't you give this in the hands of some of these friendly customers and so on? And we said, for the unification play, unless it feels like there is 70-80% in each of the individual pieces already done, and they can see the differentiation, the value prop won't really hit well with them. It won't sit well with them. And they're going to feel they're missing out on something. They're going to feel, you know, it'll lead to more frustration than happiness in the hand, you know, having the new product in their hands. So we wanted to get to that stage. We wrote a memo to the investors so that they understand why we're doing things a different way from what they're used to.
And for example, when you go to market with this product and you have defined these, do you normally work with a kind of set of customers, more like a beta customers, or at earlier stage, more understanding situations that customer, it does not expect a very mature product. So they're willing to work with you closely and provide you feedback rather than, you know, look at it as a kind of, this is not what I expected. And essentially, you know, you may not appreciate that kind of feedback at the very, very earliest stage, right? So how do you manage that with some clients that you wanted to bring them in, but at the same time, you need their feedback in a different way with a different set of expectation?
Yeah. Our approach was, we went deep with around 10 companies fairly early. Through the whole design process, what is known as design partners in SaaS these days, but I don't call them design partners because they never agreed to use our product once it was ready or anything like that. These were just people who are passionate about the space that we aligned with and said, hey, we want to keep you posted. We want your inputs on a regular basis. We sent them some swag and books and so on very early so that, you know, they get something in return for their time spent with us. And so those 10 were one bunch where we could ping them at any time and ask them, hey, how do you do this? How do you do that? Do you like what I'm building, etc.? Right? So we could ask them any question about anything and they'll give us good answers. They'll send us like, here's the kind of reports we look at. Here's what leadership wants to see. Here's what my team member complains about. So we knew their world in and out. And then there were another 110 folks who, over that period of a year, we got in front of, showcased, got some feedback, got a sense of which ones will be warm or cold when we actually launch the product. When we launched, we reached out to those 110, but it so happened that we also did like a product hunt launch and announced our funding on the same day. It took off well on product hunt, became number one product for the day, for maybe it was number two or number one for the week as well. And that meant we had a lot of inbound traction as well. And once you have that momentum from customers who are asking for stuff, like they're signing up for a trial, they're getting on demos, then your focus goes to whoever's showing that intent already versus chasing that 110 list or 120 list that you had created. So we actually, I would say, focused on those who signed up from like the online presence and, you know, from our PR and product and launch and so on. Those who came from the other list on their own over the course of the next year, yes, we engaged them, but we weren't chasing them to make them customers. We focused on who was signing up inbound.
Yeah, so the early customers get that kind of plus, but also have the minus. Mm-hmm. The plus side, as you said, they are more involved providing feedback. They are part of this kind of product. They feel like we have, you know, we can influence the product based on our feedback. They receive a lot of attention from you guys. On the minus side, of course, they realize that the product is not finished product out of the box. Everything they need may not be there, but it's coming. So how do you think that your product is going to build the brand? So thinking about product in short term, you need to, you know, be quick to deliver what customers need on, with regard to functions, functionalities. And then at the same time, you are thinking longer term that what kind of brand I'm building around this product and how this product is going to impact the brand. How do you see the relationship and some kind of points that everyone should consider when they are building a product that will impact their brand?
Right. I feel there's a few aspects to this. One is, I would say the most important thing that we got right, as far as, you know, balancing that product and brand in a way, was our first hire and like a lot of focus went into design and UX. So our first hire was actually a designer, right? And, he came in with a lot of passion for everything from what our logo looks like to what my Zoom background will be to the product as well, of course, and our website. In fact, people, when we launched, they looked at our website and thought we'd been around for 2 years because we already had a podcast on it. We had a community we were running. We'd done a lot of things through that 1 year before launch. When my co-founders were building product, I was building a lot of content and assets and thought leadership and community and all of those things. So in a way, when someone came in, our best way to form that trust with them was to say, hey, you know, here, look at us. We're like already out there. We have a 700 member community. So people didn't even think of us as like a small early stage product. Then we had to tell them, hey, by the way, yes, this product already has a lot of breadth and depth, as you can see, but it's going to have a few bugs. Trust us, tell us openly where you find issues. We'll fix it. We'll work with you to develop new things. If you're like a bigger customer, you know, some of them were fairly big even early on. We also told them, hey, you're getting in early, which also means you get to influence a little bit on the roadmap. Use that to your advantage. That doesn't mean we're going to build things that you ask for, but it means if you tell us your problems and impact to your business in a clear way, we'll work with you to solve them. And some of it may be in product, some of it may be outside of product to start with, but we eventually bring it all into product. And I think the other aspect was, because the product looked good, looked clean, looked, you know, impressive, people automatically in their heads make a decision that, you know, the quality of the company is good, even if it has some issues. Let's say, you know, I started adding a lot of tasks and projects and suddenly it slowed down. They believe that we will fix it because they you know, have a quality bar where they pegged us as someone who's on the higher side because of just what the product looks like. And that's a lesson I would say. A lot of us think I can fix the UX later after the product works well, but I feel people do judge the book by its cover. And hence that cover, the website, the product, everything, what it looks like also matters a lot. And then of course, you know, even while introducing the company, we will talk about our credentials, what we've done before to establish that trust. We will talk actively about community, add them into our community, talk about our vision for the space, all of that as well, so that people are buying into more than just what the product is today.
And when it comes to building the community, of course, and, you know, creating that credibility that you have around the product and users coming and joining and, you know, using your product, how do you think that you would do it next time differently than what you did? Of course, this time around, you had a prior experience, so you did it in a way that it was better because you learned from the past experience. But if you had a time machine to go back and do it again, or if you do it the third time, how would you do it differently? What kind of, you know, company and activities and communities you will build that will establish your brand in a way you want around the product?
Yeah, I feel we did a lot of things well this time, so I don't know if I'll change much about it. Especially on the community front. Maybe the first 3 months I didn't focus on building a global community. I was first building it in India with folks that we knew well, and then we went global with community. I would focus on building it global from day one. Now, this community playbook, I feel it's not for everyone. For example, if you're building in the sales and marketing space, there are so many communities already. You don't want to build one more unless there's a very differentiated angle to it where you can say, hey, this is only for these kinds of salespeople, or this is only for these kind of companies. For us, for implementation and onboarding and PS teams, there wasn't anything. So we were very much able to be that first community in our space, and that was a big advantage. And I feel we focused a lot on content, on like hosting people for webinars, thought leadership content, bringing out stories from people in the community. What we could have done even more, I would say, is maybe, you know, very actively give people badges or some recognition that they can post on social about, you know, what they did in the community, or, you know, if they've mentored someone or they've earned points answering questions, etc., then maybe some badges, something that they can share with the world about the progress they've made and how they're able to help others. Because I think that will automatically make it more visible to more people that, hey, this community exists and these people are contributing to it and they're sharing their learnings, etc. I feel we focused a little more on what's happening within the community and just inviting people in, you know, code. It still worked well for us, but maybe one more thing to do is that gamification, badges, etc., which could have helped it even further.
One of the things that I have seen many times in software companies, when they are at the earlier stage and they need to bring customers, they need to finish product, they have a lot in their plate, and they have that sense of urgency that we have to really move fast. And that's how they can really go to market and compete with many established players, that they may not have the same sense of urgency. And that startup also, after some years and having a very polished kind of release, and the product is established now, is mature, the customer base is there, maybe they have, you know, the same situation after a while. And they get to the point that now somebody else come in with higher sense of urgency and can really win the race. Overall, in technology, that's what, you know, is happening. That some companies, even some of them very big companies, but they have that sense of urgency. Somehow they managed to really keep that alive and fresh. And they are really there innovating, moving forward. They don't slow down. And they are the ones that normally, you know, capture the market and become the leaders, versus some companies, some startups, some SaaS companies especially, that they may get into the comfort zone and that sense of urgency go away. And then everything goes to a kind of, you know, just a regular, okay, company just, you know, doing the operations in daily basis. How do you see your company in that kind of, you know, way of culture? Do you guys, you know, sense that we need to really do something and move faster? And how do you initiate that kind of sense of urgency if you do?
I think we value action bias and velocity and momentum quite a bit, right? I say velocity and momentum. It's the same thing in a way, but velocity also has the direction. And, you know, in that sense, we hire looking at who are people who will help us move faster, who will challenge us to move faster. For example, we hired a VP sales globally now recently. And one of the clear things we chatted about was to understand each other's speed, right? And only when we were convinced that he's actually going to help us move even faster, he's going to challenge us, push us harder to move faster, that we said, okay, you know, makes sense to bring this person in because he's going to pick up the pace further. Likewise, when I hired our VP of customer success, the main thing we bonded on was the action bias. Like, you know, he literally said something like, in my first 90 days, very often leaders say, I will come, I will observe, I will listen, I will watch and learn, right? But this gentleman said, hey, you have, at the time he joined, we had around 400 customers. He said, this is a good time for me to actually be able to call each of these customers, because calling 400 accounts over a period of 2 months is not a big deal. We can actually make 5 calls a day and still manage to do that, which was, you know, in my head, the right thing to do for us was to actually be able to revive, to reactivate, to regenerate that, you know, rejuvenate the engagements with many customers that we have. And that calling approach will make a huge difference versus writing an email, waiting for someone to set up a meeting for you. No, that's not going to happen. It's going to just drag on and on. And after 3 months, you would have met maybe 30 customers, right? So I wanted to see that action bias. The other thing I would say is purely product velocity. When we as a company, as a team are, you know, talking about product velocity, we're glorifying product shipping velocity. We have all this, you know, CI/CD, like a modern, you know, it's like Facebook, right? We ship versions of the product every day, multiple versions a day, like code is going to production multiple times a day. And I know sometimes an enterprise customer may be afraid that this will break something for me, but it may. But, you know, our whole approach is fix it very quickly if it breaks, roll back very quickly. We have all of those things in place so that it's not going to really hurt a customer. But this modern approach to software building, which is not let's do 3 releases a year, 2 major releases, 2 minor releases, whatever, you know, the way it's done needs to be you're always on the latest version of the software. You're getting enhancements every day, every week. So that's our approach. And I think customers have been really stunned by the pace at which we've shipped things for them. And I know there is more to build, more to ship, but people have the trust because they see every month that we are making very impactful changes to the software that they're using.
And for a second, think of SaaS versus traditional software company, meaning a subscription-based versus a non-subscription-based business. What would have changed in your company if it was not subscription-based? If you were just selling software in an old-fashioned way and people buy the license forever, it's perpetual, and you don't see them anymore. They just use the software. Now you need to go and just find a new customer. Of course, you get more money up front, but it's not recurring. In a type of business that you are running, you know, I wonder what would change in your life, in your world, if that was the case.
Yeah, I feel, you know, for the kind of the way we build product, etc., a lot of our customers wouldn't even be successful with us if we just sold a version of software and let it be and sold them an upgrade or update, you know, a few years later, etc. Just the nature of how we build, how we think about problems, etc., needs that iteration. It's like saying, hey, you know, a movie could be a hit or a flop for various reasons, because once you release it in the theaters, you don't, you know, have the opportunity to go and update the script and the, you know, dialogues and the acting iteratively each week based on audience feedback. And so it could have been a flop, right? Like if you just put out a software and don't have the opportunity to make changes, you may have some assumptions that have gone wrong, which don't allow us to, you know, continue to sell into the market. Whereas now with the way we do things now, you know, we have plenty of opportunity to keep innovating, stay competitive, bring new ideas from our customers to life as well. Because when they use it, they come up with better ideas than we may come up with. And we need to listen to them. We also need to bring our own ideas. And that's how great products are made.
So in your metaphor, then it's more like making a TV series with a lot of seasons, and each season has different episodes and people coming back every week and just watching one part of this story, rather than really going to a movie theater and just listen to the whole 2-hour story, 3-hour, whatever it is, and say, I'm done. Now I know the whole story, right?
Yeah. So I can develop the plot based on feedback for last week's episode, right? So yeah.
That's interesting. So yeah, so it's hard to imagine now that we live in this kind of, and you're right, it's not just the model of the revenue model that is subscription or not, it's also, it impacts a lot of other things, the way you support your customer, the way you build your software, you know, the product building itself, the brand, everything changes when you really think about the way we do SaaS today versus what software industry did 20, 30 years ago, in a more selling a perpetual license. And then, you know, you receive some updates and maintenance and support, but that's essentially the software you buy forever to, you know, use it perpetually. Very interesting. At the end, I would like to ask you for a recommendation for a book, or some books if you like, or anything, any source of information that you think it's really informative, has been very life-changing in a way for you and impacted what you do positively, either personally or professionally.
Sorry, can you repeat the question?
Yeah, so I wonder if you can recommend a book maybe, you know, anything that either personally you liked it or professionally.
Sure. I have a bunch of books that I believe, like, I get influenced quickly when I read something. I'm like, okay, this has got some ideas going in my head. But I, you know, when it comes to the most impactful, maybe I would say, I'm going to name three. One is Competing Against Luck, which sort of changes how you think about product, this whole idea or notion of jobs to be done. And, you know, you're hiring a product to do a certain job. It gives you a very different framework to think about what you're building. Then I would say Made to Stick, which is, you know, I think it originally probably meant for, right, from journalism to advertising to branding, everyone, how do you think about communicating ideas in a impactful way in which it'll stick with the reader? And I found this book to be very useful as a, you know, giving me a framework to think about how do I leave a message with, whether it's internal teams or with your investors or with customers or the market in general, how do you communicate things in a way in which they will remember? And lastly, on the personal front, I would say Leadership and Self-Deception. Heard about this book from a friend of mine, the founder of a company called ChargeBee. And it really changed. It made me much more aware about when I get defensive about things. Because I think that's a common quality all of us have. When we get feedback, the first thing we think of is, okay, no, I didn't want to hear that feedback. Here is why I believe it's wrong, or, you know, some reason why it doesn't apply to me versus, you know, let me be open and let me understand what I'm hearing better and make changes.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for the suggestions. It has been great to have you, Siri, on this conversation. Again, thanks for joining us. I wish you all the best.
Thank you so much for having me on today. Enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you for listening to SaaS Scaled with Armon Ashraghi. For show notes and any resources mentioned in today's episode, go to saasscaled.com. If you're enjoying our show, give us a 5-star review and share on LinkedIn. And be sure to subscribe for any updates on future episodes. Thanks for listening. This episode is brought to you by Curve, the modern no-code analytics solution, the tools you need to take action with your data on a platform built for maximum scalability, security, and cost efficiencies. If you're ready to reduce complexity and dramatically lower costs, then contact us today at curvey.com. That's Q-R-V-E-Y.com.